afternoon. Welcome back to the Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas. We have one case this afternoon. I will ask our Chief Deputy Clerk, Deborah Spisak, to call.
May it please the Court, Ms. Erica Copeland will argue the respondent, Mr. Dovin-Cosa will argue for the state.
May it please the Court, Mr. Kosob. As I'm sure the Court is aware, the record in this case is voluminous. And as I was trying to figure out how to wrap my brain around what to do to argue this case, and going through all of the evidence and trying to make sure I remembered all of the details, it occurred to me that there's really one thing at the heart of this entire case, and that is the fact that Mr. Vafayan was originally indicted for transporting chemicals with intent to manufacture methamphetamine. And that case was predicated on a parties theory. In the middle of the motion to suppress hearing, the state realized that they weren't going to be able to get there from here, and they changed horses in midstream and asked for permission to reindict the case. That permission was granted. The continuance that the defendant asked for was granted. Then they came back with an indictment of money laundering. And I thought to myself, this is kind of the Al Capone thing. We know he's doing something wrong. We just have to figure out a way to get him into court. The problem is that they tried it and they investigated it as a drug manufacturing case. And once they brought it to court, they were unable to show me the money, basically. They were unable to tie the money part of the money laundering case into the illegal activity. I'd like to start with the suppression issues, specifically the 322.04 vehicle stop. In that case, in that particular stop, there was some pseudoephedrine, receipts, batteries, camp fuel, ether, and a deposit slip taken from the car. The court said that was okay, that stop was okay, because he consented to the search. And it's our theory, and I think the brief makes it clear, that the officers pulled him over and started searching before they ever actually got any consent. I think if you look at page 83 of the record, volume number 2, and the testimony of that officer involved, he basically pulled him over and started searching his car. And the consent, according to the officer, it all kind of happened so fast. There was no deliberate, clear consent to search that vehicle.
Did he have plain view raise its head?
Plain view was raised, but the problem is that carrying around 4 boxes of pseudoephedrine in your car is not illegal. That's not contraband. So it's our argument that, you know, so what? He saw that there were 4 boxes of pseudoephedrine in the car. That's not illegal. So that wasn't something that was permissible for him to just go ahead and start searching for.
So if he'd have seen ether and some tubing and some batteries and some pseudoephedrine in the car, none of which is illegal, still that's not enough? He has to have something illegal in the car?
Well, with all due respect, the ether and the batteries and all that stuff was in the trunk of the car.
No,
that
just
wasn't what he saw. And my personal humble opinion as a defense lawyer is, no, that wouldn't be good enough, because those things, possessing those things in and of themselves, is not illegal. I think that there are courts who would disagree with me, and maybe if there were those things in combination in the front seat of that car, perhaps at that point it's arguable that there would be a plain view issue. But it's our position in this case that the just seeing a bag from Target or Walmart or Walgreens or whatever store it was he was at that day with pseudoephedrine in it wasn't sufficient, and that they hadn't actually obtained the consent. It's our position that the court needed to determine whether or not there was a legitimate reason for the stop. The court didn't really do any kind of analysis. He rested his decision with regard to that stop on the consent issue and didn't delve any further or make any findings any further on that. It is our position that even if he had, he wouldn't have been able to get there, because there wasn't really any testimony about why they stopped. They stopped him for this. He was driving erratically. Okay? So he was stopped for driving erratically. They didn't testify about a specific crime that was committed or traffic violation that was committed that caused them to pull him over. Once he was stopped, there wasn't any citation issued for any kind of traffic violation. And at that point, the purpose of the stop was effectuated, and they should have discontinued everything. And then we get back to the consent. You know, he says, well, you know, he's consented and let us go ahead and look in his car. We submit that that's not what the evidence shows, that there was no knowing consent. It was all contemporaneous. They got out, they started looking, and got what they wanted out of it.
Was this a stop for which they had followed him before that to three different stores, and he had purchased two boxes at two of the stores, each of two of the stores, before they stopped him?
I don't believe so. I think that was the next stop, and I could be wrong. If I am wrong, and it was that day, then it's our argument that, again, purchasing those products in and of themselves are not illegal activity. Those aren't crimes. It's not crime to go into a store. This smurfing that the police officer referred to is not a crime at this point in time, and was not at that time, and they didn't have a reason to continue to stop him.
Okay.
And I believe, I could be wrong, and I'm sure the state will correct me if I am wrong, I think that took place the next day, and it could have been at the next stop. It's our position that to continue to detain him and rifle through his car and open up his trunk was part of the fishing expedition type searches that are prohibited under the Constitution, as Justice Ginsburg talked about in Ohio versus Robinette. The next stop was the stop in April where they put a tracking device on his car and basically followed him all weekend based on a warrant that they had obtained for a crime he allegedly committed back in January of 2004. They had this warrant in their hand before they followed him all the way to Shreveport. They could have arrested him before he ever left, but instead they wanted to follow him around and see what he was doing. So they did, and they followed him all the way to Shreveport and back. And it wasn't until he got home that they arrested him and searched his car. In that particular instance, the court said that the car was seized pursuant to an inventory search after arrest on a lawful warrant. It's our position, first of all, that that's not an inventory search because the car was not impounded. The car was in his driveway. It was never impounded and wasn't taken anywhere for an inventory search to occur. It's also, I have scoured the record, and I don't believe there was any evidence or even a suggestion that it was a plain view type situation, because I believe that everything that was taken from the car at that particular point in time was taken from the trunk of the vehicle as well. The automobile exception doesn't apply because, again, he's parked in his driveway. He's not anywhere near the vehicle. There's no evidence that he's fixing to leave. They've arrested him. They're going to take him to the police department. There was no probable cause that there was contraband in the store because, again, pardon me, going back to the argument that I made earlier, they're looking for pseudoephedrine. And at this pseudoephedrine possession at this point in time, what they were looking for was not an illegal activity. Having four boxes of pseudoephedrine or two boxes of pseudoephedrine was not illegal in and of itself. So this was not a search incident to arrest, because while he was arrested, the search wasn't restricted to that passenger area that's talked about in those search incident to arrest automobile exception type cases. They actually went into the trunk, and that's where they continued searching for more of what they'd been searching for in the past. From that, we go on to the warrant applications. First of all, we'd argue that those warrant applications were based primarily on evidence that was, or in part, they were based on evidence that was seized as a part of these first two illegal searches. For that reason, they're not valid. The second part of our argument is that they were based on stale information. The warrant affidavits themselves talked about years and months worth of investigation that happened, years and months away from the time that the application was sought. The information that actually addressed or was more close in time to this particular warrant application was obtained from known criminals. And it's our position that the reliability prong of the test fails in this particular instance, because there isn't any assertion in the face of the application as to whether or not the there was any independent corroboration, whether or not these people were reliable, whether or not they had ever provided any reliable information in the past, whether or not they were, and again, they were unnamed sources, obviously, and they didn't go through the steps that, that you go through to assess the reliability prong of such an analysis. There just wasn't any information about these people and what they had given them in the past and why there was any reason to believe them this time. And again, there was not a crime at this point. They're still looking at manufacturing methamphetamine with him as a party to this. He owned the store where allegedly these people were getting these items, but that in and of itself was not enough. And I think that that's evidenced by the fact that the state decided it wasn't enough and decided not to pursue this case based on that theory. And that takes us to the money laundering. He was indicted specifically for obtaining $100,000 from possession of pseudoephedrine with intent to manufacture methamphetamine. It's our position that he was tried for manufacturing methamphetamine under the law of parties. That's what all the evidence was about. Now, there was some evidence about money, and I'll get to that here in a little bit, but most of the evidence came from accomplices as a matter of law. And those accomplices were basically the meth cooks themselves and the people who drove Mr. Vafian around, allegedly, to purchase the pseudoephedrine. That testimony did not prove that the money that he got, he received from a criminal activity. Their testimony, they didn't have any knowledge. Most of them didn't know. Most of them made no averments whatsoever about whether or not he knew or what was going on in Mr. Vafian's mind or had any indication, and they couldn't have known. They didn't have any way of knowing, but those that did have any conversations with him at all certainly didn't say anything about knowing that he knew where this money was coming from.
What about the employee?
Who? The girl that worked there like a couple of weeks.
Well, that he admitted to an employee that he sold pills to meth cooks.
That he knew, yeah.
I think... And I'm sorry, there's a lot of evidence.
Yeah. An employee said that he told her or him that he knew he was selling to persons who were going to cook meth and that was the way he stayed in business, something to that effect.
Honestly, I don't have an answer for your question. I think as far as her statement goes, that in and of itself is not enough to show that the money that they're alleging that was ultimately discovered was alleged in the indictment was enough to connect that money, that amount of money, to criminal activity. I think that one single statement doesn't really show his knowledge. And other than that, we've got nothing. I can't really tell you. I mean, I just think the problem with this case that I have always seen is not really it's the knowledge, but it's also the money involved. He's got some money around, but there's no trail. There's no money trail. There's no paper trail. There's no expert that comes and testifies about profit and loss in this business. And it's the state's burden to show that he has taken $100,000 or more and done it and taken it from this illegal activity. And that's the big gaping hole, one of the big gaping holes in the evidence, is that that's not there. There is some money around. You know, he's got money at home in a store in a safe deposit box. But having money in your house, in your store, and in a safe deposit box, cash, that's not illegal. And this is, and it's not a crime in the state of Texas. This isn't the situation with Al Capone where the IRS comes in and says, hey, you're not reporting your cash. This is a situation where they're trying to show that he had $100,000 that he got as a result of this illegal activity. And the evidence in this particular case is just not there.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Ms. Copeland. Justice, my name is Dobie Kossab. I'm here. I'm an assistant district attorney from Wichita County. The evidence was absolutely presented to the jury for them to make a determination that the appellant was guilty of money laundering. Ms. Copeland says that the underlying theme here is that the state at some point decided that we couldn't make a case for possession of chemicals with intent to manufacture, and that our whole prosecution fails in regards to that. Well, that's not true. What we realized was that we could, in fact, make a better case for money laundering. There was no evidence presented at trial that Mr. Buffine was actually going out to manufacture, although I don't think that's what would be necessary to show such an infraction. We recognized that we could show that he was making proceeds from selling the pseudoephedrine and the other precursors knowingly to drug manufacturers, and therefore tainting that money that he's bringing in. I'd also point out that had we constrained ourselves to the charge of possession of chemicals with intent to manufacture, we were simply pursuing a second-degree felony. Based on the state of the law at the time, that money laundering charge and the threshold amount that we were able to show, I do believe we actually showed in excess of $400,000 that he took, showing that over a threshold of $100,000 made that a first-degree felony. And if he wants to engage in that type of activity, I believe the state is justified in bringing the most serious charge that it can. Turning to the suppression issues, Justice Gardner, you were correct. Prior to the traffic stop on March 22nd, the officers involved had observed Mr. Buffine go to three different stores, and they had observed him purchase pseudoephedrine at two of the stores. Upon leaving the second store is when Officer Spraggins observed what's characterized as erratic driving, but more specifically, he gives articulable facts that he saw the defendant signal to turn one way and go a different direction, and he knew that was not right. So he initiated the traffic stop. I think in context of that traffic stop, one has to be familiar with the shenanigans engaged in by Smurfers in Wichita County and the North Texas area. This was typical behavior from going from store to store, buying multiple packages of pseudoephedrine. So when he sees that otherwise legal material on the front seat, but for the facts that he had just observed, he may not have a plain view exception to get into an automobile. However, he did see it, and he knows what these people do. He sees it on the front seat of the car. I do believe that he had probable cause to search that vehicle for possession of chemicals with intent to manufacture. You have to also understand at the time, please, that Officer Spraggins had likewise been involved in this ongoing investigation of Mr. Buffine, and he had all that requisite experience and knowledge about Mr. Buffine's activities at the moment of that traffic stop. As the court found, the trial court found that consent was given at the time of the traffic stop. There was evidence by two officers there that Mr. Buffine, in fact, did say that it was okay to look in his car. Mr. Buffine testified later at the suppression hearing that he gave no such consent. However, the court determined, based on its own analysis of the witnesses and their demeanor, made a credibility determination that the officers were telling the truth and that he had in fact consented to the search of that vehicle. I want to move on to the April 27th stop. Ms. Copeland in her brief and today says that was probably impermissible because the officers had a warrant in their pocket for Mr. Buffine as he traversed to Louisiana and stopped at a bunch of stores in the Metroplex on the way, and then came back and back in the Metroplex, did the same thing, and finally, 3 days later, made it back to Wichita Falls, which she calls a fishing expedition. I call excellent police work. There is no commandment that says the officers, upon possession of that warrant, have to arrest somebody the moment they see him. That is demonstrated by this court in the Pettigrew case. The facts are, strikingly analogous. In Pettigrew, officers from Arlington, I believe, knew Mr. Pettigrew, saw him drive by, they checked him for warrants, knew that he had an outstanding warrant, and they followed him for a time. Once he arrived, they didn't pull him over immediately, although they could have, since they knew who he was, and they had a confirmed warrant. They followed him for a time, and he arrived home, and they arrested him, and then conducted a search incident to that arrest at his dwelling, of his car, and that was upheld by this court to be reasonable. The same facts are here in this case. However, there is a second basis for that search. Based on what the officers have seen on that trek to Louisiana and back, based on what they have seen Mr. Bafayan do, they can develop substantial probable cause that he's engaging in illegal activity, I believe, and I think that would get them into the car, into the passenger compartment of the car. However, what they did do upon the arrest is they searched his person, and in his pockets they found copious receipts for pseudoephedrine, batteries, and starter fluid. And that, I believe, would give them, enable them to develop valid probable cause to get into the trunk, and which, in fact, they found 87 boxes and cans of starter fluid and numerous batteries. So in multiple ways was that traffic stop and the arrest on April the 27th valid. We'll talk about the search warrants briefly. Ms. Copeland said there's no corroborating evidence presented in that warrant to substantiate what these confidential informants have provided. Therefore, there's no probable cause for the search. And that's not accurate. As our brief points out, there were a total of 9 confidential informants utilized in the formulation of that warrant. 5 of them operated at the direction of the investigators to go into Mr. Bafayan's store and make large purchases of pseudoephedrine and batteries and starter fluid all at one time, which in and of itself would be suspicious, as testimony and trial later tell us. I don't know how one can be more corroborating than to have somebody act and come back and say, this is what I've done, and here's my evidence. Also, in that warrant, in the multiple warrants, the recitation from that employee that spoke directly to Mr. Bafayan, who said, I couldn't keep this store open if I was just selling groceries. What keeps my store open is selling pills to drug cooks. That was in the warrant. That certainly would give a reviewing magistrate, based on the totality of the circumstances in that warrant, would give a magistrate the ability to formulate a reasonable probability that instrumentalities of criminal activity would be found where we thought it would be found. Those warrants were valid. They did establish probable cause for the search. I guess just to emphasize, I'd like to address finally this point about the money, that the state was never able to prove that Mr. Bafayan, the money that we found and recovered, in excess of $400,000, was connected to the sale of these pills and these other precursor materials. If you listen to the testimony of the accomplice meth cooks, the 5 of them that testified, they each testified as to their fee schedule and what Mr. Bafayan would charge, that being about $350 for a case of Sudafed, paying $16 for one bottle of pills. They were talking about paying in excess of between $4,000 and $7,000 per transaction to Mr. Bafayan in cash, and were doing that multiple times per month, even per week. And I think the whole case, Ms. Copeland has her theory, but I think the whole case, this whole case is encapsulated in one piece of evidence that is before, as she's talked, she's right, this is voluminous. It's a mountain of evidence out there that y'all are going to have to weed through, but there's one particular piece of evidence that I think you should pay close attention to, and it'll show you the whole case in microcosm, although I can't remember the exhibit number. It's a video, it's a clip of surveillance video that was captured in one of those searches, and it's the defendant's own surveillance camera. And what's happening is he's standing at his counter, and one of the accomplices, Matt Shear, who's in the federal penitentiary now for distribution of methamphetamine, is seen on the video. Mr. Shear is seen to be writing numbers down. And we learn through the trial that this is part of their habit, that this is how they make their orders, if you will. And he also has two cans of starter fluid and some batteries in a brown paper sack. And they're talking. You can tell that they're conversing. And all of a sudden, their conversation is interrupted by a small child who comes into that store. Nobody else is in the store but the three of them, Mr. Vafine, Mr. Shear, and this small child who comes to the counter and places his soda water up on the counter, and he slides it towards Mr. Vafine. And Mr. Vafine takes his money, and he rings something up on the cash register, and he makes change from his drawer, gives the child his change, and the child goes away happily with his soda pop. He then turns his attention to Mr. Shear, who continues to cipher there on that piece of paper. And then Mr. Shear presents a large wad of cash, counts out some bills, hands the cash to Mr. Vafine, who takes the money and sticks it in a box beneath the cash register. Doesn't ring it up, puts it straight into that box. Those searches, those seven search warrants, as I've already detailed it, maybe ad nauseum, recovered over $400,000, and most of it in small bills, small denominations in various locations, including the store, the Crystal Mart, and at his home. Money packaged in small denominations in bundles. And that is exactly what this case is about. This man was making money from the meth cooks because they had money to spend, and he was going to be able to provide them the chemicals necessary to produce methamphetamine. And that money is what was tainted here, and that's what he was found guilty of, and that's what he was sentenced for. Do y'all have any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to touch on a couple of things briefly. The state has talked about the fact that they proceeded with this money laundering case because that was a better case than the manufacturing case. And I think, again, it all boils down to the fact that the state didn't present enough evidence that linked this cash that they found to the illegal transactions. There were numerous other explanations for the cash. And while they may not have all been explanations that the state liked, there were explanations for why this man had that much money. And there's not a trail. There is not a trail of this money. They don't have $100,000 worth of people coming in there and giving him a handful of cash and walking out of the store. So I think if you carefully look at the records in this case, and I know that you will, or if you haven't already, that's the big problem. That's a big hole in the whole case, is tracing the money, showing the money, finding out whether or not that money actually was money that was generated as a legitimate business operation, was generated from insurance proceeds, was generated from gambling in Shreveport, whether or not the money actually was tied to these drug offenses. And just a couple of other things I'd like to touch on with the stop issue and the question that was asked earlier about, you know, was this the same day that he was driving around and had stopped at a couple of other places. I think that all of that kind of goes to the heart of the argument on both of those stops, and that is when he went into the first Walmart, you suspected that he was doing something illegal, or he went into the second Walmart and you suspected that he was doing something illegal. You had that reasonable suspicion at that point in time. Why did you need to wait until he got in his car and he drove down the street and started weaving and winding down the road to stop him? Because you wanted to look in his car, not because you thought that what he was doing was illegal at the Walmart, because you wanted to see what else was going on in that vehicle. And the same thing goes for why.
But that doesn't really matter, does it? I mean, it doesn't really matter what the officer's subjective intent is at the time of a stop, as long as he has reasonable, articulable suspicion or probable cause, right?
I think that probably, I think, yes, it does. To me, yes, Your Honor, it does matter. It matters because prior to that time, ostensibly under the officer's theory, he didn't have reasonable, articulable suspicion. Just because the guy went into the Walmart or the Walgreens a couple of times, he didn't have enough or he would have stopped him. He waited until he saw him doing something erratic on the street, and at that point in time, he had a reason to pull him over. He admitted that having those four boxes of pseudoephedrine was not a crime. So just, and I understand the process of the smurfing and they're watching him and all that kind of stuff, but just walking out of Walgreens with two boxes of pseudoephedrine is not enough, and that's kind of the whole point of our argument on the plain view issue. And I don't believe that. It goes back to the warrant. You can't follow him around for 3 days with a warrant in your hand. Pettigrew was a later on that day kind of case. At some point, you can't use that warrant forever to just wait and see how much rope this person gives themselves to hang themselves and then decide you're going to pull them over and start looking through their car. And it's our position that they didn't have reasonable, articulable suspicion at that point in time because what he was doing, going in and out of the stores buying pseudoephedrine, was not illegal in and of itself.
Thank you very much. Thank you both for your arguments and very helpful briefs. That will conclude our afternoon session, and we'll recess.